You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell. My guest today will be familiar to many of you as the creator and driving force behind Cruising Outpost, one of the most popular magazines for sailing and cruising communities worldwide. Before that, he owned and ran Latitudes and Attitudes, another magazine which met what he describes as an inglorious end. He has founded other publications too, Biker Magazine, Tattoo Magazine. He was famously Evel Knievel's travelling companion in the early 70s. To say he has crammed a lot in would be understatement, and today we will get to it all eventually. Bob Bitchin, welcome to Boat Radio.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Mike.
It's great to talk to you. It's difficult to know quite where to begin, but we have no time limit today, so let's just transport our listeners back in time to the 1940s. You were born in Los Angeles. Were your parents, was your family, a particularly adventurous group of people?
Well, my mother was. My mother was born in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, as her mother, my grandmother, was running from Russia at the time they were having the pogroms, and her family was being wiped out. So her husband sent her across on a boat to the United States when they found out she was pregnant. And when she arrived, she had already had the baby. And so my mother had to go around the world because they wouldn't allow her into the USA because she wasn't on the manifest. So she had to go, my grandmother had to take her back to Russia, and they had to do it again. So she went around the world before she was 2 years old.
Whoa, that sounds like the most extraordinarily bureaucratic inflexibility there.
Well, it's worse now, but that doesn't matter.
Do you have siblings?
I have an older brother who is a PhD chemist, and I have a younger sister who has a master's in computer science.
From the way you said that, I detect that you almost wanted to say that you're the black sheep of the family.
Oh, yes, definitely, and I'm proud of it.
What about your childhood? What sort of life was it? What did your father do? Did you live in a fancy neighborhood or an ordinary neighborhood?
Well, first of all, keep in mind, I'm still a child. I mean, I'm 73 years old, but I'm still mentally about 14. And I had a what they would call an upper middle class upbringing. I was born in Los Angeles during the war, before the baby boomers. So I'm 2 years ahead of the baby boomers. So I don't have to put up with all that stuff. I was raised in a middle upper class, or an upper middle class. I don't know. It doesn't exist anymore. But it was, we had nice house. We had a swimming pool. I was fortunately raised in the San Fernando Valley area of Los Angeles, which is where all the movie stars and all the television people were. Until I was 16 years old, I didn't realize that everything I watched on television wasn't just my neighbors.
So which neighbors? Who are we talking about? Lloyd Bridges?
Well, let's see. I lived across the street from the Cisco Kid, which was a big television show at the time. Roy Rogers lived up the street from us until he moved to Apple Valley. Clark Gable lived at the end of the block.
Clark Gable lived at the end of the block?
Yeah, we had, I went to school with Annette Funicello, Brenda Lee, and a lot of people that, you know, later, you know, got into, you know, singing, show business and stuff, because I went to Hollywood Professional School, which was a school that was created by MGM for teaching the kids on the sets. And as I had been kind of asked to leave a few high schools in my prime because I don't know, they thought I was doing something wrong. I, of course, was just having fun. But finally, the last school available was Hollywood Professional School. My mother happened to know the owner of it, so she let me in. And that's where I stayed until I went into the Air Force.
Is there a degree to which you've maybe rebelled against some of this?
Yes. Yeah. Actually, my nickname back when I was a kid was Treb. My parents still call me that, T-R-E-B, which is Troubled Rebel. because I used to, it's not that I never ran away from home, but I went on adventures starting when I was about 14, where I would just, me and my buddy would hitchhike someplace like Texas. And I'd leave my folks a note, Mom and Dad, you know, it's not that I'm upset with my home life, but I just want to go have an adventure. And I did that when I was 14, when I was 15, when I was 16. Finally, when I was 17, I joined the Air Force. And
well, at least you left a note.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Every time I left, I didn't want them to think I didn't like them because I loved my parents. And see, I'm a very lucky person. My parents actually stayed married their entire lives.
You are absolutely right. I don't know what the statistics are in the United States, but in the UK, about half.
That's same here.
Did either your father or your mother ride motorcycles?
No. My father was, he was in the Second World War. He was at the Battle of the Bulge. He was wounded. And that's when he left the theater of war. But he was in the service. When he got out, he went to work for my mother's parents, who had a carpet store. And that's what he did the rest of his life. But the odd thing is that my father went to school when he lived in New York for journalism, and he ended up never writing a single thing. I never went to school for anything special, and so far I've written 9 books and 1,100 magazine articles. When I got out of the Air Force, and I did go back to college, because in the 60s we had the GI Bill, which paid for college. Right now it's annoying as heck, because like my granddaughter, she just graduated from college and she's got a $60,000 student debt. When I graduated, I didn't have any debt because it was covered with the GI Bill. Things have just changed a lot.
Sure. I mean, your parents obviously quite well off people. Did they own a sailboat?
No, they never sailed. They never did anything on a motorcycle. It's kind of hard to explain, because I was a very normal, very, very normal kid until I was about 15, and I started to rebel at 15. And to me, rebellion was seeing something that scared me and then doing it to prove to myself I could do it. And so the first time I ever saw a Hell's Angel, we were driving down Highway 101 in my parents' station wagon, and 10 bikes pulled up next to us at a stoplight on Highway 101, Ventura Boulevard. And I remember I didn't even want to look at them in their faces. I was so intimidated. And years later, I couldn't wait to go meet some of them and get to know them and prove to myself that I could participate. And so that's how I got into motorcycling. I ended up for 20 years riding around the United States and Europe, writing stories and helping organize the outlaw motorcycle clubs into a political organization, which we called ABATE, ABATE. And it stood for a Brotherhood Against Totalitarian Enactments, or a bunch of assholes totally inebriated, depending which one you wanted to use. We formed an alliance between all of the outlaw motorcycle clubs, what we called back in the 60s and the 70s, the one percenters. And one percenters are outlaw motorcyclists that were referred to by the American Motorcycle Association in the late 40s, saying that 1% of bikers were giving motorcyclists a bad name. And of course, we took pride in the fact that we were that 1%. So we started wearing patches that said 1%er. It was kind of fun, actually.
What was it that sparked your interest in motorbikes? I mean, it wasn't that encounter.
Actually, it was. It was one night I was in the carpet business, because that's what I was raised in. After I got out of the service, I opened a store, and I had about 3 stores by the time I was 21. I carpeted a Honda dealership, and he gave me a 305 Honda, and in exchange for the carpet. And I rode it one day, and I happened to be up in this area that's, you got to remember, this is the 60s and the 70s. where everybody hung out on Wednesday night, the cruise place, which was Hollywood Boulevard, and I met Laco Bob Lawrence, who was the president of the Hells Angels Los Angeles chapter, and I was just very impressed by his presence. Let's say that he was 6'6" and about 400 pounds, and we became friends. I mean, really good friends. In fact, when he came down with diabetes, I used to go to Weight Watchers with him because he wouldn't go alone. That was kind of funny.
That is just so strange.
And everybody wonders, you know, how I met Knievel. I was on a bike that I just finished souping up. It was a chopper. And I was on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood. And this guy pulls up next to me in a Maserati convertible wearing a fur coat. And I thought he was gay. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but... I looked over at him, he looked at me, and I revved my engine, and he revved his engine, and we raced to the next light, and I knew I was going to kick his butt, but I didn't. I mean, he wiped me out. And so he looked over at me and smiled, and he said, "You pull in that driveway up there, I want to see your bike." So I pulled in, not knowing who he was, and he's looking at my motorcycle, and I'm looking at his Maserati. And then I noticed the license plate number, which was Evil, and from Montana, and that's where Knievel's from. And so I figured out who it was, and he said, "I'm going in for a meeting here, but I'm going to be at this place later called Filthy McNasty's down on Sunset. I'll buy you a drink." And so I went directly to Filthy McNasty's, which was right across the street from the Whiskey A Go-Go on Sunset Boulevard, and waited for him to get there. When he got there, he walked in with a bunch of people. I bought him a drink instead. Then he bought me a drink, and we ended up until 4 o'clock in the morning, which is 2 hours after closing time, drinking in Filthy McNasty's. And all was well and good until the police came in at 4 o'clock and raided the place because you're not allowed to serve alcohol after 2 a.m. And so they arrested the owner of the place, and Knievel handed me a handful of money and said, "Would you mind going down and getting them out?" And I'm like, "No, I didn't have anything to do." So I drove down to the sheriff's station and got somebody out. And that was the owner of Filthy's. And I don't know, from then on, it just, you know, the next day I went to give Knievel his money back, and he needed somebody to catch him at the top of the ramp at the L.A. Convention Center, or at the L.A. Coliseum. And his pilot wouldn't do it. He was afraid to go up there. So I said, "I'll do it." And I went up there and I caught him, and I traveled with him for 3 years after that, until he went in the Snake River. And that's when I started my first little newspaper for bikers.
What a story. I get the sense reading about you in the research that I've done for this interview that your life is a series of quite bizarre stories and encounters and happenings and experiences. And it's all, I mean, is it luck? Are you charmed? I mean, How does it feel from the inside?
I think that you could probably say that it's gross stupidity, because I have this thing where every once in a while, instead of turning right out the doorway, I got to turn left. Every once in a while, when something presents itself, and most people would say, "Nah, that's too much trouble, or that's too dangerous, or that's too stupid," and they don't do it because they're intelligent and they turn right out the door and keep going the way they have been for years, I turn left. I see, it's like, yes, that's the way I got started sailing. I mean, I was a hardcore biker. I mean, I spent 20 years, rode over 500,000 miles on motorcycles, wrote thousands of articles and two books about motorcycles. I think the highlight was in the late 70s, after Knievel, and we'd started Abate of California, which was our local legislative group. And pretty soon it was joining with Abate charters of other bikers from other states. And then we started Abate National, and I was the first director of Abate National. And this was an organization of outlaw motorcycle clubs that were at war with each other many times, but whenever they needed to communicate, they would do it through Abate, through the central. So if they needed to know something about, is this person a member or something, we could settle that. And I was contacted by somebody who was writing for my magazine at the time, who lived in Lyon, France. And they invited me over to have a meeting with the outlaw clubs in Europe. And that had to be the highlight of my life, actually, because that's when AMF owned Harley-Davidson. And AMF said, yeah, we'll give you a bike over there if you want to fly over. And so I flew over and got on a brand new Harley, which in Europe in the 70s was very, very odd, and rode to the Nontron area of France, the antique region, and met with 300 bikes from outlaw bike clubs all over Europe, from England, Switzerland, Germany, Spain, I mean, from all over. And we spent a week there, and that was just way too much fun. I ended up writing a book about that. But basically, I found that the people in motorcycling that, when I first saw them, scared me, were really very, very neat people to know. I mean, they were different. Some were a little too aggressive. I ended up as a bodybuilder for years and taking martial arts for years because I wanted to feel comfortable.
You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell. My guest today, Bob Bitchin, founder of Cruising Outpost magazine, Latitudes and Attitudes magazine, Biker magazine, Tattoo magazine. He's a rider, a writer, and an accomplished sailor who has lived aboard boats for, I think, around half his life. After the break, we're going to find out a little bit more about his latest venture, a radio station for the cruising community worldwide. Do not miss this.
Bonnie Lass Charters is Mallorca's number one experience.
Bonnie Lass is a 57-foot converted fishing boat. She was built in 1949 as a herring ring netter in Scotland, and now she's set up for the Mediterranean. Apart from just relaxing in the sunshine on the deck, there's paddleboarding and any kind of exploring you can imagine up along the north coast of Mallorca here, quite often with Maggie the dog in tow as well. Bonnie Lass Charters is unique because no charter is really the same. We work really hard to make it the perfect day for each individual client. To be able to go out and enjoy the day with the guests on board is just fantastic.
For more information and to make a booking, visit bonnielasscharters.com.
You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell. I'm talking to Bob Bitchin, whose fascinating life has been, and I think continues to be, filled with adventure and extraordinary achievements. Bob, I want to talk to you about your new radio station, Pirate Radio. But first, you know, you talked about it before the break. The name Evel Knievel is one that stirs a lot of childhood memories. The word, for me, certainly, the word daredevil evokes images of that white suit with the blue V with the stars on it and cape flapping behind him, and also that terrific Harley-Davidson XR 750 dirt track bike that he used to ride. Goodness knows how many of those he wrecked over the years. Why did he never jump the Grand Canyon? I've got to ask that, actually, before we move that. Why? It was left to Robbie to jump the Grand Canyon after his father died.
The Grand Canyon is a national park, and the national government would not give him permission to do it. That was that simple. The Snake River Canyon, they did allow it, and he actually made the Snake River Canyon jump. He did make it all the way over. Unfortunately, he had messed up when he was designing with Bob Truax. Bob Truax was a NASA engineer who designed the peroxide rocket that they called a motorcycle, but it wasn't. It was a peroxide rocket. It had two wheels. I guess that made it a motorcycle. I was standing at the foot of the ramp, and before he'd moved 5 feet, the parachute had blown straight down and was at my feet. So he was pulling the parachute open all the way across, and he did it. Wide World of Sports was there, and they had a photo from the side, and they showed that he had cleared it and gone over almost 100 feet over to the other side, but then the wind caught the parachute and blew him right back down into the canyon.
Brilliant.
Oh, yeah, he got $2 million for that.
Just inspirational, anyway, absolutely inspirational. I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for people who push things to the limit like that. Bob, this takes you to the mid-1970s, right?
As soon as he'd gone into the canyon and was retiring, I had to do something to make a living. So I started a little newspaper called Biker News, which was a tabloid. I'd never even been in a newspaper office before, but I went to a local newspaper printer and I said, what's it cost to print, you know, a newspaper? And he told me, and I said, so what do I need to give you? And he told me. And so I started a little tabloid called Biker News. It lasted just about a year, and then I sold it to Cycle News, which was a big company. And from there, I just kept moving up and up and up in the publishing business.
When did you meet Jody?
Jody was the bartender at the Portofino Hotel, Yacht Club, and Marina in Redondo Beach, California, King Harbor. And I'd known her about 4 years. I lived on my boat 35 years. I had 8 different boats, and I started very small. My first boat was a Cal 28, and that's what I taught myself to sail on. What finally changed my life was a boat called Stonewich, which in the 70s was the flagship for Greenpeace.
I was going to ask you, what's your connection with Greenpeace? How did you come to be a crew member on board Stonewich?
Well, it's not as altruistic and as it might be. What happened was, in Northern California, they were building a new nuclear plant called Diablo Canyon. And a lot of people were against building a nuclear plant. And so Greenpeace was blockading the entrance to Diablo Canyon, the harbor. And Jane Fonda was on board with her political boyfriend. And they came out and arrested her. And as they were taking her ashore, Alan, the builder of the boat and the owner of Stonewich, said he heard them say they were going to come back and seize the boat. So they pulled out and sailed down to Santa Barbara, and a friend of mine was crew on the boat, and he called me up and he said, have you got $8,000? And I said, for what? And he said, we need to get this boat out of the country. And I said, yeah, I can do that. Can I go? And then he said, yeah, we're going to Guatemala. So about less than a week later, the Stonewich, which was a 74-foot square-rigged topsail schooner with no motor, 421-foot sweeps, oars, a radio that you hand-cranked, kerosene running lights, and no refrigeration, pulled into Redondo Beach, King Harbor, and I jumped on board with my then-girlfriend, Patty, and we sailed south to Guatemala for 3 months, and it changed my life. The motorcycle lifestyle was kind of violent and very drug-ridden. Being on this boat probably saved my life, because I can tell you right now, at 73 years of age, 99% of the people who I knew at that time are either dead or in jail. And I've never been either, so that's pretty good.
So you sailed to Guatemala on board Stonewich, the Greenpeace flagship.
Yeah.
And you gave them $8,000. And did you get the money back? And did you come home to California and immediately buy a boat?
Yes, no, and yes. No, I didn't expect to get the money back. I was doing that to help them get the boat out of the country. And I figured it paid for 3 months' passage for me and my girlfriend to sail on this phenomenal boat all the way to Guatemala. I mean, it was the adventure of a lifetime at that. I was still working on the magazine, the motorcycle magazine. I was at that time doing Biker magazine. But I only had to be home 1 week every 3 weeks, because we were monthly. So I'd sail for 3 weeks, and then I'd fly home and get out an issue of the magazine and then fly back. And one break, I had to fly from Mazatlan on the Pacific coast of Mexico to Daytona Beach, Florida, to cover the Daytona, whatever you want to call those, the parties. And then I flew back and sent the story up. So I was able to stay basically for almost 4 months sailing on this boat that we drank tepid Kool-Aid and we took turns cooking and cleaning. And sometimes it felt like we were pushing the boat to Guatemala, because no motor. When we'd get becalmed. But it was the adventure of a lifetime, and it changed my whole lifestyle. I remember waking up at sea and grabbing a cup of coffee in the galley of that boat that smelled salty. I mean, it just, this was just a salty vessel. And walking up on deck, and there's always somebody on watch when you're moving. And one morning, Alan was there, the guy who built the boat, Alan Olson. And we're sitting there, and we're both about the same age, but he'd been in boats his whole life. And I was 32, I think, at the time. And I'd never been on a boat until like 3 weeks earlier when I bought my little Cal 28. Literally, it changed my life. I stopped doing drugs. I really, really got into the lifestyle of cruising. And that's, you were asking about pirate radio. Jimmy Buffett did a song, "I'm a Pirate Born 100 Years Too Late." I don't consider myself a pirate, but a modern day pirate, which means somebody who goes out there and lives by his rules without hurting anybody. That to me is the best life you can have. When you're a captain of a boat, you're in charge of your life. There's nobody out there that's going to come get you if you're doing major crossings like I used to love to do, crossing the Atlantic, crossing the Pacific. I sailed to Hawaii 7 times there and back because it's being at sea is the most enjoyment you can get out of owning a boat. Because the farther you get from land, the less you worry about hitting anything. I mean, the chances of two boats colliding in mid-ocean is so infinitesimal that the calculations would befuddle a computer. When I sailed, the first 3 times I sailed to Hawaii, which is 2,700 miles, and back, I only saw one boat, and the closest we came to it was 8 miles, and we saw it on radar. That's what it's like out there. It's blissful because the only thing you worry about is what's for lunch, what's for dinner. How am I going to finish this book? And I don't have any more books on board. We got to get someplace to buy one. That's your biggest problems when you're out there. When you're living in civilization, you're always trapped by, did you make your insurance payment? Did you make your car payment? We have to drive here. We have to do this. When you're on a boat, the only thing you have to do is if something breaks, fix it and eat. Breathing helps too. When you're out there, life is like a dream.
You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell. My guest today is Bob Bitchin, founder of Cruising Outpost magazine, Latitudes and Attitudes magazine, as he just mentioned, and numerous other publications too. And his latest venture is a radio station, pirate radio, no less, and it's for the cruising community. We're going to hear all about it after this break.
Bonnie Lass Charters is Mallorca's number one experience.
Bonnie Lass is a 57-foot converted fishing boat. She was built in 1949 as a herring ringnetter in Scotland, and now she's set up for the Mediterranean. Apart from just relaxing in the sunshine on the deck, there's paddleboarding and any kind of exploring you can imagine up along the north coast of Mallorca here, quite often with Maggie the dog in tow as well. Bonnie Lass Charters is unique because no charter is really the same. We work really hard to make it the perfect day for each individual client. To be able to go out and enjoy the day with the guests on board is just fantastic.
For more information and to make a booking, visit bonnielasscharters.com.
My name is Matt Rutherford. I am the only person in history to have circumnavigated the Americas nonstop. I've sailed alone across the Atlantic twice. I've crossed the Pacific. I've sailed through the Bering Sea and around Cape Horn. I understand the challenges you will face trying to accomplish your blue water dreams. And I know how important it is to have the right boat. Whether buying a blue water boat or selling your blue water boat, Rogue Wave Yacht Sales has the experience to make that happen. Email me at matt@roguewaveyachtsales.com.
You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell. I'm talking to Bob Bitchin, whose life has been just packed with adventure. And that hasn't happened by accident, has it? You've sought adventure. You're a person who seeks out the unusual, the strange, the weird, and you relish it.
Kind of. It's if I see something that makes me think I can't do it, I have to prove to myself I can do it. It's like the first time I sailed to Hawaii. I'll tell you the truth. I was scared to death. I mean, this was before GPS, and this was before I could afford sat-nav. Loran existed, but I couldn't afford that either. So the first time that I sailed to Hawaii, I used a sextant, and I didn't know how to use a sextant. I had a neighbor who was very, very adept at using one, and he tried to show me, but I could never figure it out. So as we sailed down south going to Cabo San Lucas, I tested it every day by taking a noon sight, which was the one thing I could figure out how to do. And it worked. So then after we loaded up in Cabo, we turned towards Hawaii. We headed west, and we were out for 2.5 weeks, and just using a sextant. And a little over halfway across, we saw the ship that was 8 miles off, and I radioed it, and I said, can you give me a position? And he did, and it was 800 miles from where I thought I was. So I didn't have it down the best, but I did figure out what I was doing wrong, and we did manage to find Hawaii and our way back, and thereafter, everything was fine. When we finished our sailing all over the world, we'd sailed to Europe and the Mediterranean and everywhere, except for South Africa. I did not go there. We did not do a circumnavigation. We did a huge figure eight sailing from the Pacific coast to South Pacific to Australia and that area, and then back up into the North Pacific and then back to California, stopping just long enough to annoy our friends by telling them, no, we're not staying. We're leaving again, and we're going through the canal and going the other way. And then we went through the canal, and we did some time in the Eastern Caribbean and then sailed across the Atlantic into the Med, spent a season in the Med, came back to the Caribbean, spent more time there. But it wasn't a circumnavigation. We just sailed all over the world, every place we had ever really wanted to go. On our return is when I had to figure out what to do to make a living. And I don't know if you realize how hard it is to eat if you don't have money, especially when you're 6'4" and weigh 300 pounds and are covered with tattoos. People aren't apt to run up and hand you dollars, you know what I mean? So what I did was, two of my best friends, who when I had the motorcycle magazines, they were both in the magazine business and motorcycle magazines. Bob Clark, who started Custom Chopper, which was the very first custom motorcycle magazine, and Keith Ball, or Bandit, who was the editor of Easy Rider for 30 years. They were my best friends, still are, and they're both still alive. This is a good thing. And so they sat down with me after I returned home, and we're trying to figure out what I'm going to do to make a living. And we came up with, well, why not start a boating magazine like the motorcycle magazine you used to do. It was very well received by people who never before would read the stuffy boating magazines, the, let's say, yachting magazines.
Have you always had this kind of can-do attitude? Because it's all very well to sit around with a couple of mates and say, I'm going to start a magazine. But it's a very different thing altogether to then go and actually do that, right?
I think.
So where did this kind of can-do attitude come from?
Well, I don't want to get mundane about it, but it's from my mother and father. Whatever I did, they supported. It must have been very difficult for them when I was in my late 20s riding with the outlaw motorcycle clubs, getting covered in tattoos. My mother was Jewish. Getting a tattoo when you're Jewish means you can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery. She was horrified by it, but she still supported me. And my dad always told me, whatever you're into, get involved. Act enthusiastic, and you will be enthusiastic. So everything I've ever gotten into, with the exception of eating and going to bars, I've ended up in that business because I love business. That's what I studied when I did go back to school after I got out of the Air Force, business administration. I love business. And I guess the best example of that is when we started Latitudes and Attitudes. We started a magazine with $30,000, which is impossible. and it became the number one selling marine title in the United States after about 3.5 years. And life got where it couldn't be any better. Now, do you have to take a break, or should I tell you what happened?
Keep going.
Okay,
don't stop.
Here we go. We had reached what I felt was the pinnacle of success, which means I had a magazine that was making a profit that I did not have to work hard at, and a television show and a radio station. I'd written 3 more books, so I had a total of 7 books out at that time. It was about as good as it could get, and I was looking at 70 from the other side. This is like exactly 5 years ago. And a couple came to me at the Oakland Boat Show and said, would you be interested in selling the magazine? And I thought for less than a second and said, absolutely, because I wanted to go sailing again. We were just finishing building a new Shannon that we had started a year earlier in Bristol, Rhode Island. It was my dream boat. We had sold the Lost Soul, the boat I'd lived on. We were there. We were ready to retire. I was 60, I think 68. I had to be. I was 68 at the time because I'm 73 now. They said, you know, can we discuss it? So I gave my address up in the Sierras, and a few days later they drove up and we had lunch and we talked. They didn't have the money, and the price was 1x annual revenue. They didn't have the money to do it. But 3 weeks later they came back up. They called and brought up 2 new people and said, these people have the money. And I said, really? So we decided to sell the magazine. And the price was simple. It was $1.5 million, $500,000 up front, then 90 days to pay the other million. They had a letter of credit, which was turned out to be phony. We accepted the deal. We signed a contract selling them the name.
Whoa. The letter of credit
yes.
turned out to be phony.
Yes. But I didn't check it because I trust people. Also, I've in because of what I've done all my life, people don't tend to try to annoy me or steal from me.
Yeah, I get it. You're 300 pounds, you're 6'4", you're covered in tattoos,
exactly.
And you used to be a Hell's Angel, right?
Right.
So, yeah.
So, you know, I've just never worried about it. I've always, my whole life, I have always done business on a handshake. A lot of people say that, but everybody who knows me knows that. The most important thing to me in my life is my reputation. So what we did was we accepted the deal. And at that time, we had an apartment down at Portofino in King Harbor. I had my house up here in the Sierras on the ranch that we had just finished building to do their 90-day due diligence. I let them use the apartment down there, and we came up to the house here.
Bob, we are going to take a break now. Let's do a quick break, and we'll come back in a second. You're listening to Boat Radio. I am Mike McDowell. I'm talking to Bob Bitchin, and I'm on the edge of my seat to find out exactly what happened with Latitudes and Attitudes magazine, or rather the Latitudes and Attitudes media empire. Bob's going to tell us after this quick break.
My name is Matt Rutherford. I am the only person in history to have circumnavigated the Americas nonstop. I've sailed alone across the Atlantic twice. I've crossed the Pacific. I've sailed through the Bering Sea and around Cape Horn. I understand the challenges you will face trying to accomplish your blue water dreams. And I know how important it is to have the right boat. Whether buying a blue water boat or selling your blue water boat, Rogue Wave Yacht Sales has the experience to make that happen. Email me at matt@roguewaveyachtsales.com.
Bonnie Last Charters is Mallorca's number one experience.
Bonnie Last is a 57-foot converted fishing boat. She was built in 1949 as a herring ring netter in Scotland, and now she's set up for the Mediterranean. Apart from just relaxing in the sunshine on the deck, there's paddleboarding and any kind of exploring you can imagine up along the north coast of Mallorca here, quite often with Maggie the dog in tow as well. Bonnie Last Charters is unique because no charter is really the same. We work really hard to make it the perfect day for each individual client. To be able to go out and enjoy the day with the guests on board is just fantastic.
For more information and to make a booking, visit bonnielastcharters.com.
You're listening to Boat Radio. I am Mike McDowell, and I'm talking to Bob Bitchin, who you all must know as the former owner and editor of Biker Magazine, Tattoo Magazine, and Latitudes and Attitudes, the magazine, the radio station, the TV show, too. It came to what Bob has described on his website as an inglorious end, and we're about to find out why. So, Bob, we've got these two new owners. They're using your apartment, and they've got to come up with the rest of the money. What happened?
Well, there was a 90-day period to do their due diligence, but I'd already signed a contract turning over the Latitudes and Attitudes TV show, radio show, magazine. Oh, and I also owned, Living Aboard magazine, too. We turned that over as part of it because I was ready to retire and go sailing. And every week I would get a report from these guys saying that they've paid off all the company credit cards, that all the bills are being paid, that everything's good and all is good. And every month I would get a interest check on the $1 million that they owed me at the end of the 90 days. And about 3 weeks into this, I started to get a little bit worried.
What was the inkling? What was it that started you worrying?
Just some of the things they were saying. They didn't allow any of the employees to talk to me. Everything had to go through them. But when I say employees, these people were family. I mean, Sue Morgan, who is still my editor, she was the editor there. I've known her 37 years. She lived on a boat. She still does live on a boat there in Redondo Beach. And she was my editor. She wasn't allowed to talk to me. They had told her specifically they would fire her if she talked to me. The same thing with our bookkeeper, Cheryl, who is currently still my bookkeeper, but she couldn't talk to me. She wasn't allowed to. She'd lose her job if she did. And then, about 20 days from closing, and I got a call from American Express saying, you just had a $9,000 check bounce. And I said, well, that can't be because, first of all, I've never had a check bounce. And secondly, American Express card's paid off. I have a report right here showing it's been paid off for over a month. And they said, no, it's not. You haven't made a payment in 2 months. So I picked up a credit card out of my wallet and I called the number on the back and it was maxed out. And then it hit me. I had over $500,000 in open to buy credit, because the way we ran our business was we had a lot of people who supplied products to us, and we put a credit card on file with each one of them. As the products would get sent out, they would invoice our credit card, and then we'd pay it every month. They had not made a payment since they went in, but they told our bookkeeper that they'd opened a new company account for the new company and transferred all the revenue that came in to that account, to their account. And they said they're paying the bills. And then they gave my bookkeeper the same ledger they gave me showing the bills being paid. Unfortunately, they weren't. So when this happened, the day this happened, it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I went, got my 45, loaded it, and was heading for the truck. My wife was like, you can't do this, you can't do this. I got to step back a half a step here. On my property, one of my best friends, he died 3 months ago, but he was my best friend for decades. He was one of the founders of the Nakawana Motorcycle Club in Hawaii, which is the Hells Angels affiliate in Hawaii. I've known him forever. He ended up retiring from the club and retiring from Hawaii, where he was building custom homes, and he moved up here to my ranch to help me build my house, and then he built a little cabin on it where he and his wife lives, because he doesn't have anything. And he's telling me not to go. Now, I'm listening to him. You know, he's like, you know, you're 68 years old. You do this, you're going to jail for the rest of your life. You know that. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, a man's got to do what a man got to do. That's, you know, the old standby. But as you get older, you realize sometimes you have to think about what you do. And I was to that age where I thought about it. And so I called my lawyer. And my lawyer said, there's nothing you can do. We just ran a thing on these guys. They have 17 judgments against them. One's over $3 million. They've done this 4 times already. There's nothing you can do. And so I called them and said, I'm on my way down there. it turned out that they went and got a U-Haul, and that night they emptied the offices. They took all the computers. They had shut down the magazine. We didn't know it. They had not paid for printing for the last two issues, so the printer had told them they will not print it anymore. The TV show had gone off the air because they weren't paying their fees. Radio station was still playing because it was on the website, but we shut the website down because they were still selling subscriptions to the magazine, even though they knew it was out of business. So, long story long, that's what happened to Latitudes and Attitudes. At this point, as you can imagine, no matter how strong an individual is, when you lose everything you've worked for your whole life, or you think you've lost everything, I ended up with my .45 in my hand sitting on a tree stump here on my property, thinking seriously about just checking out. And I didn't. Al talked me out of it. Jody talked me out of it. And I was pretty depressed because we were about to lose our ranch. We've got 40 acres up here that we bought years and years and years ago when it was almost free. That's where we built, and we love it here. And I get a phone call from a guy in New York. Says he's a lawyer. First thing I think is, okay, this is another thing, because we were in bankruptcy by then. We'd lost over $1 million, and we didn't have $1 million. So we had no income except for my Social Security, $1,600 a month. Can't live on that when your mortgage is twice that. So we're getting ready to move out of the house. We're getting ready to literally go and try to find a Catalina 22 that we could get for back slip fees, move on it, and move to Mexico and live on my Social Security. And I get this call from New York, and the guy says, you need to go to your website. And I said, there is no website. You got to imagine, I was pretty defunct here. And he says, no, your website's still up. Your bulletin board's still up. It wasn't on your website. It's on a different server. So I went to the bulletin board, and there's a lot of people there saying, we need to get a new magazine started. This is crazy, because they saw what happened. And my first thing was, no, I'm almost 70 years old. What's the stupidest thing anybody could do in their life? That would be to start a business at 70. But these guys really wanted it. So I continued to argue. They said, there's a venture capitalist in Boston, one of your readers. He'll put up $250,000 for you to restart the magazine. So here's the trifecta. You could over 70 to start a business, start a print magazine in the age of the internet, and then start something in the marine industry, which was dying since 2008.
But you did it. You did it.
That's what we did. But here's the best part of the story. You have to hit bottom before you realize what you had and can come back. And I had hit bottom. And then this guy says, why don't you put something on the bulletin board that says, send in X dollars, and if we get enough to start a magazine, I will do it. At least there's a hope. And I said, okay, but it takes $50,000 to print one issue. That's a lot of money, and I don't want anybody to lose on this. So we came up with a figure of $250 that people could send to a PayPal account. If it makes it, you'll be founders. If it doesn't make it, we'll send you the money back. That simple. 13 days later, we had $175,000 in PayPal. Our first issue was 180 pages, which was twice as big as any other marine title in the U.S. at the time because of the economy. And it sold for $7.99 instead of $3.99, which they used to sell for. And it was quarterly. And it outsold every other marine title on the newsstand, the first issue.
Tell me about your latest venture, Pirate Radio. How has that come about? You know Larry Horn, you know Dan Horn.
Right. Dan Horn and I have been partnering for about the last 5 years on Tradewinds Radio. We came up with an idea for a format for a boating radio show that is more than just the music. And it's not just talk radio. We're not trying to compete with boat radio. But what we're going to have is, I'm going to have a half-hour show where I'll interview artists like Eric Stone and like Brent Burns and like Robbie White, Jimmy Buffett if I get a chance. We'll interview them about a particular song, how it came about, then we'll play that song, and that'll be my 30-minute show. Most of it will be just music, and it'll be artists that you hear all over the world at the waterfront bars but never get airplay. We're going to give it to them.
Bob Bitchin, it has been an absolute pleasure and a privilege to talk to you. You have led the most fascinating, the most exciting, and do you know what? The most fearless life, and that's the since becoming a father, I came to fatherhood quite late in life, and I've learned that you need to be fearless. You need to set a good example to your children, and you've set a good example to us all. Thank you so much for sharing these amazing stories, the ups and the downs, with Boat Radio.
Mike, thank you very much for having me, and I wish Boat Radio all the luck in the world. Hopefully we can do more stuff in the future.
Bonnie Lass Charters is Mallorca's number one experience.
Bonnie Lass is a 57-foot converted fishing boat. She was built in 1949 as a herring ring netter in Scotland, and now she's set up for the Mediterranean. Apart from just relaxing in the sunshine on the deck, there's paddleboarding and any kind of exploring you can imagine up along the north coast of Mallorca here, quite often with Maggie the dog in tow as well. Bonnie Lass Charters is unique because no charter is really the same. We work really hard to make it the perfect day for each individual client. To be able to go out and enjoy the day with the guests on board is just fantastic.
For more information and to make a booking, visit bonnielasscharters.com.
I'm John Herlig. In Postcards from Sea, I tell stories of my travels aboard Ave Del Mar, my 1967 Rawson cutter. I deal with serious nautical issues like how to sail your mast into a tree on a canal, what kind of incense best covers the aroma of kimchi fermenting on your boat, or whether or not I can beat a leukemia patient at a video game. It's simply the story of my life, and my life happens to take place on a 50-year-old sailboat with no particular destination in mind. I hope you'll join me and some of the wonderful characters I meet as I travel for my show, Postcards from Sea, every other Monday here on Boat Radio.
Time goes forward, go and catch your jet, you will find your moment.